That's okay, but we were thinking about some sort of a lit sign and something that kind of, you know, looked like a, you know, kind of make it look a little nicer than that. So the next thing that happened was they had a couple of professional sign outfits come in and come up with a sign. And the next thing we know is our sign was $2,000, and it was a lit plastic type backlit where the bulbs, you know, you see them around them, you know, commercially used all the time. And they were just, at that time, just starting to become popular. So all of a sudden, we were up to where there was the idea for a $2,000 sign, and the Alumni Association said, well, we will try to come up with half of the money to build the $2,000 sign. And it went back up and was discussed by the administration, and decided, no, that wasn't enough, that really we wanted something a little less commercial than that. We wanted something a little more subtle. And we found out that we could get some help from the State Architectural Office, and there was he was Japanese, I believe, and he came down and looked at the campus, and so we thought, well, we'll do something a little more subtle and kind of put a gate in. Well, the gate idea, as I remember, was $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 for the gate idea, and now they thought they want something a little bit, you know, a little bit more expanded than just a gate, a brick gate or something. And then the idea came up of using a couple of olive trees and kind of a broad type gate, an entryway, rather than a gate, or rather than a illuminated sign, or rather than a painted sign. And all of this was taking place over 6, 8, 9 month period, quite a while. And all of a sudden, the project was $24,000. Now, there was no way in the world the Alumni Association, who were struggling along with their little machine stamping out metal plates trying to keep track of alumni, could ever get involved in paying half of the Bellflower entrance. Well, through a lot of sleight of hand, through the help of the maintenance department and a little bit of their budget to run water and electricity out to the corner, a lot of that cost was taken care of. The 49er bookstore jumped in as the co-sponsor of it, and the Alumni Association was given credit as the co-sponsor of it, and ended up putting virtually no money into the project. And we, in fact, Frenchie Flynn and I forget, one of the alumni went out, and they hand-picked the olive trees that went in there. And of course, it's a magnificent looking entrance. It has weathered the years, even when they had to take the lettering down from Long Beach State College and change it to California State University of Long Beach. And I feel good about that. You know, it's we were instigators in it. The project got a little out of hand, it still got done. And the bookstore, it's a non-profit corporation, ended up putting something over $20,000 into getting the, and of course, Mike, I don't know, what would it cost to build that today? And it still looks good. I don't know, really know, I kind of took you forward on a handful of little things that were all part and parcel of the university in the 50s and 60s and up into the 70s. I really think that the campus, the maturity of the campus, the pivotal point, I think, was the student union building. I really think that's the most important culturally to the campus. There's been, you know, the other great strides in the university are its prominence in many fields. I really think the art department started off filling a creative void in the community, and because of the fact that an artist's work, we don't wait for an artist to get gray hair before they finally say an artist has arrived. An artist arrives when their work is accepted, and as a result, in the early 50s, even the art department, through the graduates, became very, very well known, and of course, the art department, School of Fine Arts, is probably the one, probably the highlight of the whole campus over the years. It had an early start, and it's held up throughout the years. It's been on a continuing upgrading basis to a point where it's considered as the finest art department of any university in the West. And you've got some rough competition at UCLA and a number of other campuses, but overall, the department has grown, and it's through the graduates. I mean, you've got to have a faculty, but why, or exactly how it happened that the university was blessed with so many talented students in the beginning, I don't know. I knew a lot of people in the art department in those early days, and it was a seat of the pants outfit that once had a block of money given to them. The only time I've ever heard of any department ever really having some money, they were able to design a building, literally, on campus, which held up pretty well over the years. And they built a low-cost building because they were the art department at that point needed the facilities more than they needed the shelter. And so they sacrificed on the type of a building that they got, and they built an inexpensive building, which borderlines on an industrial building almost. It's the only building of its type on campus. And due to the fact the flexibility of the building has been used very, very well over the years. I don't think that department would have ever been given that liberty if it hadn't been for the great success that they had before then. Some of the other departments that I have watched and is the engineering department, which in the early 60s when it started was people picking up their degrees and had less than a good reputation, was not even listed among the universities or the colleges that the major corporations did any recruiting. They didn't recruit Long Beach Engineering because it didn't have any kind of rating at all. And the story, as I remember, was that Robert Vivian had just retired from USC, and he went to work for the trustee for the chancellor's office to do a survey of the engineering facilities and the system. And through that, he got to know this campus. And after he finished that, I think it was a year and a half survey, he was asked to come on campus and was given as free a hand as a line budget will allow. And he went ahead and did something that was very unique, I think was unique, and that was he went back to a lot of his SC graduates and said, hey, do me a favor, teach one class, your specialty, we'll write a course around your expertise. And these were graduate classes, and the students flowed onto campus from the major universities around wanting to get a vice president of an aerospace company's influence in their curriculum. And what happened was they came for one class and they transferred for all their graduate work here, and by the bootstraps came the undergraduate, and our engineering school is an unqualified success as early as the middle 60s, the aerospace companies had Cal State Long Beach high on their list, way above a lot of the Big Ten well-known schools of engineering. Passed them up because they were producing people with up-to-date information, not 10, 20, 30-year-old engineering information. And they were turning out practical people who were able to step into industry and do the job. And other departments develop along the same way. And it's been, you know, it's been my pleasure of being able to be close enough to watch it happen. I believe Robert Vivian spent a total of 5 years on campus, the mandatory retirement age finally came, and he had to back away. There were many Robert Vivian types on campus in the early days, because people with vision saw the opportunities to build a department here from scratch, and some of them were successful, and some of them were less than successful. This campus has, fortunately, very few real weaknesses, and has a few great strengths. The fact that the hiring of its graduates is way up on the list of many major, you know, organizations, not only business but governmental organizations. Shows the fact they've done a good job, and I don't know where we go from here, Kate.
One of the things that I'm really interested in is the relationship between the community and the campus, and how that changed and developed over the years. And you mentioned when you and Jack Dilday were the first alumni appointed to the advisory committee.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I can tell you. At the time that the alumni were not included in this group, I'm a little older and a little wiser. You know, I'm looking back at 15 to 20 years, and I really, with that kind of a background and view. And if I would have been in Carl McIntosh's place in 1960, I probably would have done pretty well the same thing he did. You know, when I was down there as a recent graduate and out in the business and just barely surviving, I guess as it was, I didn't see it that way. What he did. I think he got some very good people. He got some other people that just liked to have their picture in the paper and enjoyed being on, attached to the university for whatever prestige and so forth it was. And this is all judgment on my part. And it's very subjective due to the age that I was at the time. I felt that there were not enough workers among the advisory board at that time, that they were basically social contacts. But I really think that Max and Mary's presence in the community was very, very important. Pete Peterson was a campus man. He was very much involved in organization. I think he ran the campus with an iron fist. He was a man of the old school, as he was. You know, he was well up in years when he started this campus, and he had started LA State a couple of years before. He knew what it took to ram one of these things into being, and ram he did, and he got the job done, and he got it started. And unfortunately, I personally feel that. The a lot of the bitterness of the ramming and cramming that was apparently necessary to make things go in a driving, growing situation, a growing organization, cause problems in the faculty that have never been erased. It just went so fast that it went from a little mom and pop organization to a conglomerate in about 5 years. I mean, if, you know, taking business and putting it on the university, this is what happened. It's like starting out with 10 employees and ending up with 1,000 employees 5 years later. Speaking of employees, like, you know, students and so forth, it just was so out of proportion that a lot of mistakes were being made. But even when I was here, I was here within the fourth year, I guess, of the campus. There was a great deal of effort made on the part of some of the faculty and administrative people to be part of, and it was family-like, looking back on it. You know, even though the growth was explosive, they were still trying very, very hard. I think later on in the 60s, it was all they could do to just keep up with the paper load and the work. People that were on the advisory board in those early days were people which were influential, seemingly, at least they had high profiles in the community. I've learned as being an active member and currently vice president of the Long Beach Chamber of Commerce that a lot of these people that achieve a high community profile, oftentimes that's all they got is a high community profile. You don't see them in the committee. They show up in time for the meetings, but they don't get there for the committee work. I think that's true of any community. It isn't just Long Beach. So in the early days, there were a lot of these high-profile type people. One of the sadnesses of it was, and I won't mention the name, but one of the people who was president of the chairman of the advisory board, and very active and obviously very had a very high profile. After his death, and he was a very, very wealthy man, did nothing for the university, and nor did his widow make any effort to help the university anyway. There was no lack of money. The question in my mind, and right or wrong might be, is the fact that the affiliation with the university was a prestige, and the prestige died with the man. I think that many of the people that are currently involved with the university, it goes much deeper than that, especially the alumni who have an emotional attachment, along with recognizing the meaningfulness of a major university in their community. I think that it takes more than one level of awareness to be an involved volunteer worker. And there was a scattering of them in the 50s and the 60s. And I see a lot of the alumni now who, they say, well, why don't you hang in there and do more? And my answer to that is that I was preparing it for you. The greatest line that I've ever heard about an organization was, we had all of the past presidents of the Chamber of Commerce, and they went all the way back to 1946. And we had 23 of the 26 that are still alive were there in this room this one day, and they were all telling about what their most important thing that they did during the years that they were president of the Chamber of Commerce. And the last man, who was way up into his 80s, and when asked what he did, he said, "We talked about what you did." And really, that was so beautiful. And we did talk about a lot of the things that back in the 50s and in the 60s that are done now. The oral history program is something that's been talked about for 7, 8, 9 years, and there's a lot of work, a lot of effort getting it started, and all of a sudden it's taking hold, and it's like it runs parallel with a lot of these other things that I you know, showing you the roots and showing you the results of. It takes a long time. I think the good programs on campus have taken more perseverance than they have great intellect, you know, to make them happen. You know, most of the things that are important to this campus were not flash in the pan things. They were things that were built upon from a solid base. And I think the university is where it is today because of that. We're back to another full circle again, aren't we?
Well, you talked a little bit about how things changed when Dr. McIntosh came, that the alumni came back on campus and things became a little more orderly for the Alumni Association. What kind of changes happened when Dr. Horn came?
I think the fact that one of his first acts was taking a couple of student leaders and putting them on campus. Dennis Murray is a good example. Dennis Murray was a very fine student body president, and he was doing graduate work here, and had excellent credentials on campus. He knew how to listen and evaluate, and his career since then shows that. And he was picked. You know, I don't remember under Carl McIntosh anybody of that equivalency that was put into the, you know, he was put right out in a couple of jobs where he had exposure and so forth, and was allowed to do his job. I think that the styles of the men are totally different, and I think that I don't think that Steve Orne's style would have been as effective in 1960 as it was in 1970. I think in review of it, that Carl McIntosh did a great job. He was a country gentleman type, and he's a handsome, public type of man that did a fine job of showing the university off. You know, he was a great spokesman for the university. And he was very, very effective until all hell broke loose in about 67 or 68, and as a result of the Vietnam War and the general's student rebellion that was going on. Rebellion's too harsh of a word, but there was certainly unrest, a great deal of unrest. The game was totally different than anything that he had known when he was in Idaho and Montana. He actually served three campuses, each for 10 years, Idaho State University, Cal State Long Beach, and then he went up to Montana State University and Bozeman. He served each of those three campuses well. But he retired to the bunkers when his office started getting shelled. He withdrew. It was something that he did not know. He was overwhelmed. I'm not putting him down because of it. I'm just, you know, observing. This is what I saw, and it was sad because he was a different kind of a leader. He was a leader of the past when he came on campus, I think, was just right. When he ended up, he I don't know whether he was, I don't know how to describe it. He really wasn't a street fighter. He was a gentleman, and he didn't know what to make with all the street fighting going on. So he just stepped back out of the way, and he withdrew and then resigned, which saddens me. And I've had a chance to talk with both of them. Mary is quite a lady. I really, really love that lady. Like I said, Carl, I've always liked you. Mary, I love. And she was, you know, she was a great sidekick for him and did a beautiful job in the community. I don't know whether they'll ever be given credit for what they did in this community and the university. because of what happened that last year or two. Anyway, Steve Horn came on, energetic.
Well, just a little bit before you go on to Steve
okay.
Horn. What about, could you just talk a little bit about the sculpture symposium and maybe the speech?
Oh, yeah. I've got one or two of them out there somewhere, and they never told me where. Me and a thousand other people, and I don't know how many people. That was an idea that started off small, and all of a sudden, the next thing, you know, there were thousands of these trees available, and they got a lot of people in the community. It's one of the first times, to my recollection, that they really got a wide group of people in the community involved. I believe it was $5 a tree or something like that. That was a very nominal amount. Business people and community people and wives of business people got involved with it. The campaign lasted, I don't know, for 90 days or something. That was a very unique thing, because it was one of the first times when the community was actually involved with kind of a little bit of planning and actually doing something that has existed to this day. I know a lot of the trees have died out over the years, but there's still every spring that magnificent, you know, flowering. That was the first broad-based community support by non-alumni that I know of. The other item was?
Sculpture symposium.
Oh, the sculpture symposium. Administration and Carl McIntosh got a number of business sponsors and so forth, primarily through the help of the advisory board, which were, like I say, a lot of the business leaders in town, a couple of the old families. And they did get some support for that. I think that event was probably the first time when there was any international acknowledgement of this campus. Up until that point, it was just a local college of a larger system. We got a lot of international newspaper. For years afterwards, I remember there were sometimes the alumni were asked to go ahead and squire somebody around that was in town, artists or writers or art writers or so forth that were visiting campus. We were involved in some luncheons and so forth, and that they would revisit the symposium after years afterwards. The Alumni Association as such were not really involved with that symposium. It was done through the art department, the art associates, which was starting up at that time. Lyman Logan would be a good one to do an interview on because of the Louise Carlson Memorial Fund, which was came about. I'll tell you the story. Lyman told me the story on it. Is that he was doing her will, and she was going to leave some money to an Eastern college, I think her niece had gone to. And he asked, well, what is her connection with that? Well, none other than the fact that she was for higher education. And he said, well, we have a local campus that needs some help. And the interesting thing is Lyman had never been on the campus. So what happened was that Lyman brought her over, made her phone call, I don't remember who walked with them, but they walked around and asked what areas of interest she had, and she enjoyed art. They got her involved with the newly organized Art Associates, and she became an active member of that. And she wrote into the will a great deal of funds, which were later negotiated with some of the other heirs, and I believe the final figure was $275,000 that was left in the university. The first major gift to the university was that, and of course that the monies from that will continue to do things from now on, because most of it's in they're just spending the income other than the Block Tower, which was the Andre Block, I believe, is the artist, and it was his last design before his death, and it was not included in the symposium because of the cost of it or something. It was, and they were able to build it, and it's one of the highlights of the campus. And of course, anyway, that story of her is a story in itself. Very interestingly, of course, is Lyman Lowe, was been on the advisory board, and he and his wife gave a gift of the light display that's in the fountains in the administration building as a gift. So there are a lot of these stories how they happen, and sometimes that's a story in itself. I kind of gave you the highlights of it. Okay.
You were going to go on to tell about the differences when Stephen Horn came
on. Okay, when Stephen Horn came on, I don't know how much he knew about street fighting, but he didn't seem to have any fear of it, and he was very visible on campus. His youth, we're both about the same age. I think I'm a year older than he is.
You can
say that. This was 11 years ago. And his vitality of being willing to, keep his door open to students, and any time there was a problem, that he got up out of his chair and walked to the problem and confronted it with a style that I think was very, very important at that time. And he has carried that style forward. I think it's been modified with age and experience, and he's been involved community-wide in a different way than McIntosh was. McIntosh was more of a luncheon speaker type, whereas Steve Horn has gotten involved in the community and served on committees and in areas of economic development, and recently the airport advisory committee, where he actually did committee work, not just showed up to make read prepared text and walk out. He was actually community involved. So there was a difference in their style. He is one of the best known people in town. He was named Salesman of the Year by the for selling a university to the community, and that was about 4 or 5 years ago. So he's been recognized by his peers. That's the advertising executives named him as a Salesman of the Year. That's kind of what a different type of thing. Carl McIntosh wouldn't have got a Salesman of the Year award. He was out educating in his public addresses. He was telling people about the university. Stephen Horn was selling the university as part of the community. He was not trying to. First of all, it's impossible to sell this to every area of the university. I can remember years ago. Oh gosh, 7, 8, 9 years ago, when we were rotating our luncheons from department to department, and walking alongside Dr. Horn, and we were open into an area. I remember one time in the home ec building, and they had a little nursery there where they train students in child care and so forth and they had TVs and stuff in there, and all of a sudden he said, I didn't know this was here. Well, I didn't know it was there either. And it was one of those great discoveries is the fact that one way he could go ahead and do it is go to the department, have a lunch and have the advisory board meeting there in that department, and the department could show their wares. We always took 30 minutes and went through the department and so forth. And a lot of this was not only informative for the advisory board, but it was also informative for Steve Horn, because it was one opportunity where you get a focal point of doing it. He just couldn't, get up from his administrative duties and run down to the department and say, show me around. You just can't drop in on people that are busy. But by doing it that way and putting a focus on department after department all around the campus, And it was fun to learn right alongside of him. And I felt that about it, is the fact that Steve wasn't so sophisticated that he wouldn't admit the fact is that I don't know what all they do here. The campus is too big, too complex. The intellectual plane is so varied that no one can know this campus. You don't have to know everything to be administrator. I run my own business. And there's parts of my business that I hire subcontractors to go ahead and do because I don't have the confidence to do it. And I see Steve Horn as one of those people that recognizes the fact that he has limited capacity and he brought a number of people on the campus with a variety of skills that helped him greatly in those first 3 or 4 years on campus. A lot of them scattered out and found positions, other positions, but they came on with a new dimension, a new direction, and things have gone along quite well the last few years. Steve Horn in 1981 has mixed reviews in the community because of his strong stand on the airport. I mean, there's many people that want the airport to be developed out a little more, and I feel that he took the position as the president of the university. I have to keep telling myself that because our positions are not the same. I don't agree with his position. But I have to recognize the fact that the overflights of commercial aircraft over the campus is a very disturbing factor. And for that, I commend him for his hard work, even though I don't agree in a couple of areas. But the disagreements are small. I just don't knock somebody that's in there crying. Somebody that talks and doesn't take action, I'd certainly be far more critical of. He has gone in there and researched and done his homework on the airport. His conclusions and my conclusions are different, but I respect him greatly for that. He's known in the community for somebody that digs in. He doesn't just gloss over. And I think that's very important because in these days, the integrity of the campus is so very important. The change in this campus, as I understand it, as I see it, serving on the advisory board, is going from the conventional university with bachelor's degrees in standard fields and so forth to a place of special area interest, of graduate work and undergraduate work, of special courses to deal with specific problems in social areas, in business areas, community areas, in art, and so on. And I see the university of changing gears, and I've heard so much in over the last 11 years in the advisory board is as the gears were changing, this campus didn't come to the rude awakening of the fact things were changing. As a lot of the other universities, and University of California among them, which had some shocking things happen, because they were in lockstep and they knew they were doing the right thing, but the problem was there wasn't a following of people with the same interests. What happened here is the university has adjusted to those changes. Just like this, the program with senior citizens, a very daring thing, to go ahead and do. Impractical, costly to the university, and yet that isn't really true. This is what it looked like in the beginning, is how can you go ahead and give these people free tuition? And what are they going to do to the, where you bring somebody in at 70 years of age and they're taking one class, and what are they going to do to the curve? in a class where they're going to take all of their time, they have nothing else to do, and they're going to study in that one class, they're going to pick off the, you know, the cherry, they're going to pick the A out of that class. And the truth of the matter is they have been no threat. But it took a lot of guts to go ahead and put that kind of a program in here. Maybe some people would look at it, wait, that's what I look at. And I know it was one of the things that Steve Horn got involved with. He's gotten in some other areas like the food for the senior citizens, that program. Seemingly unrelated to the university, but when you look at it, when they own their own food services and so on, it made some sense. So there's been a great effort, a change from a education factory for the young to a community-oriented needs fulfillment. That makes sense?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's a totally different thing. You know, there's still most of the people here are younger and getting an education in a conventional way, but I think the other areas, there's been a great deal of attention made to it, and it didn't start yesterday. I mean, it started 10, 12 years ago, and I think Steve Horn is and David Gray and a number of other people saw it coming. Marge Dole, who did an absolutely fantastic job while she was here of women reentry into business. This Cal State Long Beach has got a reputation all over the West for the work that Marge Dole and the other people in the department did of women reentry. And this campus was involved in something that you read about in the paper as being current, and it was going on 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 years ago here on this campus. So the transition, this campus is modern, and I think from the very beginning, it was meeting the needs of the community, and as the needs change, the university changes. And I think Steve Horn was the right man at the time. I think he was a good choice.
Okay, one of the things that we've neglected that we always try to do in oral history interviews is to ask people about their background. And we sort of started with you at Long Beach City College.
Okay.
And I sort of don't think you started out there.
Okay, I was a son of an oil worker. I was born on the island of Borneo in Indonesia, what is now Indonesia. I was born in a little town called Sangasangadelem, which is on the east coast of Borneo, 1 minute south of the equator, which is very close to the equator. I was born in the Shell Oil Company Hospital. My father was there on a labor contract working as a driller, and was the last American employee of Shell to leave Borneo in 1932. And when he left Borneo, he came back to Long Beach, where he had lived before he had gone overseas. In a very short period of time, between 32 and 33, I lived in North Long Beach and in Huntington Beach, and then moved from Huntington Beach to Belmont Shore. And I lived on Bay 118 Claremont, which was right next to the Alamitos Bay. And at that time, there was out our back door, it was all vacant land, and then there was a street, and there was the bay. It was a block to the ocean, and as a little boy, I used to give the lifeguards a hard time. In fact, I run into a number of them, and over the years, that are, of course, much older than I am. But I used to, during the summer times, would always be out to help a lifeguard put up the barricades on Bayshore Drive at 7 o'clock in the morning. And I think that was the last time I really enjoyed getting up early, was during those times in the 30s. It was a beautiful place to live at that time. The at least one third of the lots were vacant in that the Belmont Shore area at that time. So we used to have a little clubhouse shack that we built out of packing cases on one of the vacant lots until finally the neighbors got tired of us doing it and they tore it down. But it was a very beautiful time in the late 30s and very happy times, as I remember. My father, who by the late 30s was in the drilling business with Tom Pike, starting in 37, started becoming a little more affluent, and he went ahead and bought a lot in the Las Ritas area and built a home on 3844 Pine Avenue. And kind of interesting, he bought the lot for $1,300 and built the home and put carpets and grapes and what else, and they had less than $10,000 in the entire home. And this was built over the Christmas or over the winter of 39 and moved into May of 40. And I lived in that home until I went to City College. I went to Las Ritas School, which was then through the 8th grade, and then I went to Washington Junior High School and Long Beach Poly, and graduated from Poly, and went to a year of City College. My father, who had done quite well in business and had horses all through the 40s on, ended up wanting to have a place where he could raise a few horses, and he bought 5 acres out on top of a hill in Fullerton and built a home and barns out there and lived out there in the early 50s. And then he moved.